and welcome to the VPR Vermont PBS General Election Debate Series for 2020. I'm Jane Lindholm, host of VPR's Vermont Edition, and I'll be your moderator today as we begin our series of three debates. Next week, you'll hear from candidates for Lieutenant Governor and U.S. House, but today we're joined by the major party candidates for governor. Phil Scott is Vermont's incumbent governor, having served two terms already and now hoping you'll give him a third. A Republican, Scott served for a decade in the state Senate and was lieutenant governor from 2011 to 2016 when he was elected governor. Until he became governor, he worked in the construction industry and sold half of the construction firm he owned after being elected. David Zuckerman is Vermont's lieutenant governor. Having served two terms in that role, he's hoping you'll elevate him to the state's top position. Though he ran in the Democratic primary, Zuckerman got enough write-in votes to be the nominee for both the Democratic and Progressive parties. Prior to becoming lieutenant governor, Zuckerman served in the Vermont House and Senate for a combined 14 years. He runs an organic farm in Hinesburg with his wife, Rachel Nevins. Welcome to you both. It's a pleasure to have you on this debate with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We're going to have a round of questions that I ask to start off, and then you'll be able to ask questions of one another. In the last third of this debate, we'll have questions from listeners, including some from local high school students. We'll throw in lightning round questions if we have time, and I will give you a chance to offer some final thoughts when I ask you a very broad concluding question. So let's get started. You'll have 1 minute to answer these questions, and if I ask you a follow-up, you'll also have a minute to answer that. In January, the governor will still be dealing with significant unemployment and an uncertain economic future, including the potential for more shutdowns in hospitality, the skiing industry, schools, and businesses as we see what happens with COVID-19 infections. The budget process this summer was aided by a major influx of federal funds that could be used for COVID relief. Given the uncertainty that significantly more federal funds will be forthcoming to states, how are you thinking about balancing the budget without further harming the most vulnerable Vermonters? Phil Scott, we'll start with you.
Well, we've actually already done that, Jane. We went through the last quarters of this budget recently. We're getting to the end right now. The legislature's poised to vote on that, the final outcome, and they're working with their conference committees. So we were able to balance the budget this year without reducing any benefits from those in need by using surpluses from last year's budget, one-time money, and it's not ideal. But we are very fortunate to come to a place where we had the surpluses available, which was incredible. Thinking about the last this past fiscal year being with a pandemic, but we still had surpluses for the, again, for about the third or fourth year. So we're very, very fortunate to have that on our side. Fiscal year 22 is going to be a different story. That will be very challenging. And that's why we have to get back to the fiscal fundamentals.
Well, and that's actually what I'm asking about. What will happen in fiscal 22 for whoever is sitting in the governor's seat? What is the strategy, knowing the uncertainty around the economic picture and federal funds?
I think we have to go back and rekindle the same playbook that we were using over the last few years. It got to us to a point. We didn't raise any taxes or fees over the last 3 years of any significance. We will continue to do that. I think the legislature usually takes a knee-jerk reaction and raises taxes when money is tight. But I think that's the easy way out. This isn't the time to increase the burden on Vermonters. This is a time to get back to the fundamentals and make sure that we provide for those in need, but also focus on the economy. And we have an opportunity to do so.
David Zuckerman, same question for you. How would you think about the right way to balance the budget while protecting those who probably need more money?
Well, I think it's important to remember that before we knew we had that surplus revenue from last year, the governor proposed cutting 5% across the board. That is not going to be caring for our most vulnerable. When we cut 5%, the majority of that is in human services, those programs that support vulnerable Vermonters. I would look to the Rainy Day Fund, which we fortunately have one of the most robust in the country, to help us get through. And yes, while not knee-jerk, I would look to Governor Dick Snelling, who, when times were tight, said we can lean on our wealthiest Vermonters to say, let's help us get through these difficult times. we need to make sure we do not do an austerity budget that cuts support for our most vulnerable, that will cut the services we need, that will cut the future out from our children. This governor also is ready to cut the funding or not provide the funding to bridge the gap for our state colleges. We cannot go into the January budget thinking we can cut our way out of the problem. We need to find efficiencies and use our money well, but not hurt our vulnerable citizens.
Are there areas where you could see increasing taxes? For example, we've been hearing a lot, and it's anecdotal at this point, we don't have hard data, but hearing about people coming into Vermont, or into Vermont, buying houses, moving in from other places, perhaps people with more means than the average Vermonter. Is that an area that you would look to?
Well, as I referenced a moment ago, we could look to our wealthiest Vermonters, including those that are new folks that move here. We need to make sure that when they move here, they also recognize that that's driving up housing prices. And we need to make sure to invest in affordable housing so that working Vermonters, struggling Vermonters, aren't forced out of the housing market. We need to make sure we do a budget that supports hardworking, struggling Vermonters to get through this pandemic. Thankfully, we are doing very well with respect to our health in this moment and our COVID rates, and we need to keep it that way. And we need to make sure that Vermonters don't suffer due to the economic struggles by way of the cuts that the governor proposed this spring that he would carry forward next year as well, from the sounds of it.
Let's move on to a second question. We've now entered what I think is the fifth week of protesters occupying Battery Park in Burlington, where they've been calling for the firing of three Burlington Police Department officers, among other things. This week, they secured the departure of one officer, a sergeant. Governor Scott, you've called that particular situation a totally local issue, but the issue of racial justice and policing is far from just a Burlington issue, as both of you well know. Protesters around the country want a change to how police departments are structured, how much money goes to fund them, and what their role is in society, with an aim toward addressing systemic racial inequality in the justice system and beyond, and the disproportionate racial inequality of Black Americans who are killed at the hands of police. Even for those who don't align themselves with the Black Lives Matter movement, many believe that changes need to be played to the role police play in our society, particularly when it comes to how we deal with people experiencing mental health issues and in how police officers are trained. So what is your vision for policing in the 21st century? David Zuckerman?
Well, I think we have to look at policing more as public safety and community service. We need to look at the Reverend Al Sharpton's remarks with respect to defunding police, where we reprioritize some of our funding. And the legislature started to do that this year, indicating that we should have mental health workers in with our law enforcement officers when they approach situations, because many times we can de-escalate those situations with different expertise than that brought forth with law enforcement. We need to work hand in hand in our communities to make sure law enforcement is trained well with respect to implicit bias and de-escalation techniques so that we don't end up with situations like we had in Burlington and we've had in other parts of the state, where folks end up feeling like the police are not there in a collaborative, protective approach. We have to honor our law enforcement officers as well. They're going into situations never knowing what the situation might be, what harm might befall them or others. And so there is definitely a balance in the training for our law enforcement officers and respect for them and making sure we support our communities with public safety.
Would you reduce the funds that currently go to the state police?
Well, as I just mentioned, it's not about reducing the funds, but it is about reprioritizing those funds, making sure to use them as we are in the legislature, shifting some of those resources to add mental health professionals, social workers, and others. We have to look at also—
So you would have the social workers and mental health workers embedded within the police department, not separately funded and separate from the police department.
Well, correct. We need both. As we saw in the Franklin County barracks and Grand Isle barracks, when experts went with law enforcement as part of the law enforcement team, and I should say public safety team, they have seen great results reducing the number of people that are then arrested and put into jail, and instead looking at some folks for the needs that they have. Sometimes it's a mental health issue. Sometimes it's a public health issue. It might be realizing that this person is strained because of housing needs or economic stress, and making sure they get connected to the issues, to the supports in our human services arena. Folks also face huge issues with addiction and substance abuse. We need to be helping them, not putting them in jail.
Phil Scott, what about your vision for 21st century policing?
Well, again, first of all, I'm very happy to hear the Lieutenant Governor agreeing with my budget proposal as he sat behind me in the budget address back in January. It was actually my budget proposal that would embed mental health professionals in the barracks. We had a pilot project that we've been utilizing over the last 2 or 3 years, and it's been successful in Franklin County in the St. Albans barracks. So we wanted to expand it to all barracks. So very happy to hear these agreeing with that, as well as the implicit bias training that we've been advocating for, we've been putting into practice, we've been actually doing with the Vermont State Police, and we're expanding upon that. I released an executive order to address these racial justice issues as well. You know, systemic racism is real, and we need to work together, both law enforcement and communities of color, to make real progress. And we need both sides at the table. Black lives do matter. And I believe, we are making significant progress in that regard. But we can't stop. You know, this is something that's an ongoing effort. It's not a one and done type of approach. This is going to take everyone working together in order to make significant change.
The state legislature has now overridden Governor Scott's veto of the Global Warming Solutions Act. So the state now has a mandate to aggressively reduce carbon emissions, or it could face legal battles. The way the law is written, the governor and the legislature have limited say in how the state meets those standards. Much of that power falls to a 23-person panel. But many of the panel's members are going to be officials in the governor's administration. So that's, in some ways, your real influence in shaping our emissions reduction strategy. How will that affect who you choose to have in these key positions in your administration? Governor Scott?
Well, again, let me remind everyone, this unelected, unaccountable council of 23 members, 15 of them are appointed by the legislature, 8 by the administration. It only takes a quorum of 12. So they don't even need the administration to do this. But that wasn't what was really unconstitutional from my perspective. They can abdicate their authority. They can give it to anybody they want, but they can't circumvent the administration, the executive branch. And that's exactly what they did. There's no say. They don't have to come back to anybody. They don't have to come back to the legislature for approval and what they do with the majority of members to really debate this as they've done in other states. We're the only state that's done it in this way. And that's why it's unconstitutional. It's just the bill is flawed. But let me be clear. Climate change is real. And I believe we need to reduce carbon emissions to eliminate and address the carbon emissions, as well as address climate change. So from my perspective, this just felt political in order to check the box. It's like the easy button for Staples. You know, you just press it. We've finished, we've completed, we solved climate change here, and let's
but
move
But nonetheless,
on.
It is law. So presumably when formed, until there are lawsuits that could change the course of what happens, you would be putting people onto that panel. Would that change your strategy? Would you change if you were reelected who sits in those positions?
Yeah, I mean, they are pretty prescriptive as to who sits on that if you've read the bill. So it'd have to be administration officials and secretaries and cabinet members. So we will put our best foot forward. Again, we'll play the cards that are dealt, but it's a bad hand. It's just a bad bill.
Lieutenant Governor Zuckerman, what would you do in terms of thinking about who you'd put in these administrative seats to influence what our emissions reduction strategy is?
Well, let's start with the issue here. The climate crisis is real. I get it every day on my farm. Vermonters are digging their wells deeper because they're dry right now. We have fires in the mountains in Killington. This issue has been mounting for years, and there has been inaction at the governor's level. He created his own commission and didn't follow the vast majority of those recommendations to tackle the climate crisis. Vermonters want action now. The legislature is saying it's no longer okay to just put forward goals that are ambiguous. The legislature and the governor and government as a whole need to be held accountable. When it comes to the appointments in my administration, I've been talking for a long time about breaking down the silos. I would want a Secretary of Human Services who's thinking about the whole global picture, from folks' economic struggles, their housing struggles, and how the environmental issues like Irene impacts them. That would be the case in all my secretaries. So I would welcome this bill. I'm glad that it's becoming law, because my administration is going to be looking at all the issues from the different perspectives of the different secretarial positions. And I will appoint people that will look at the environment as well as their specific focus in their agency.
Are you concerned about the part of the bill that allows the state to be sued if it's not meeting its emission standards?
Well, let's be clear, two things. The Attorney General reviewed the bill and said it is constitutional, regardless of those of us that aren't lawyers claiming that it's not. And when you look at the legal framework, the legislature greatly restricted where and how those suits could be done with respect to damages or the expert witnesses and the costs that would come into it. And so the idea is to give citizens the power, because we as elected officials have not done the job to tackle the climate crisis. Let's look at the impact on our maple industry, our ski industry, our tourism industry, our waterways, our agriculture. We have opportunities to build a climate economy for the future, looking at sequestering carbon in our soils through agriculture and forestry, through weatherizing people's homes and saving them money on their bills. We need to be looking forward at addressing the climate crisis. And this bill, I believe, and law will stand up to legal scrutiny.
Well, that concludes round one. This is the VPR Vermont PBS 2020 debate series. Today, we're hearing from the gubernatorial candidates David Zuckerman and Phil Scott. When we come back, they will have a chance to question one another on their policies and priorities. Stay with us. This is the VPR Vermont PBS 2020 debate series. I'm your moderator, Jane Lindholm. And today we're hearing from two candidates for governor, incumbent Governor Phil Scott, the Republican nominee, and current Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, the progressive and Democratic nominee. In this round, the candidates get a chance to ask each other questions. And honestly, this is often the most kind of interesting part of the debate, where we see what the questions want to push one another on, what the candidates want to push one another on. Candidates, your questions should be short, and please make sure they do have a question mark at the end, no declarative sentences. Answers can be a minute, and you'll have 30 seconds for a follow-up. David Zuckerman, you get to go with your first question for Phil Scott.
Sure, Governor. S-169, the gun bill that would have required a 24-hour waiting period for a background check with handgun purchases or transfers, passed the legislature and was sent to you last year. 85% of gun deaths in Vermont are suicides, and public health scientists have concluded there would be fewer homicides and suicides if there was a waiting period for gun purchases. In your veto statement, you said, "We must now prioritize strategies that address the underlying causes of violence and suicide." What strategies or programs have you implemented to reduce gun deaths in Vermont, and why won't you follow the advice of public health scientists on this critical issue?
Well, as you are well aware, I'm the only governor in history to sign major gun legislation, at least here in Vermont. It was a major step forward. It drew a lot of controversy throughout those many months. And I think that we have an opportunity with all of that we did during that time to perfect the bill. The red flag provisions that are in the bill are something that that need further work. The background checks were great, I believe, and significant, but there are improvements to make there. You need to look at what we're doing in order to provide for more mental health funding and so forth. Just perfect what we did to do it better. The provisions in that bill were very isolated, a 24-hour waiting period for handguns in particular. Most of the suicides that we see, unfortunately, are those over the, you know, male, more of age, so to speak. And I think that when you look at that, they typically have guns available at that point. So the 24-hour waiting period sounded like a good thing for some, but I don't believe it would be that practical in some respects and would disrupt what we're already doing.
Very brief follow-up, David Zuckerman.
Well, I'm very concerned in that we can prevent youth gun deaths. We can prevent individuals from committing suicide. We can protect women from domestic violence in the spur of the moment purchases and just ask people to cool off for 24 hours. And to me, I believe that's why we need to support this, to follow the science, follow the research, and protect Vermonters. I know Vermonters across the board, including myself, greatly appreciate your courage and your shift 2 years ago. There's no doubt about it. And thank you for doing that. But there's more that we can do to protect Vermonters while also still preserving our hunters and our other citizens' rights to own the guns they need for their protection.
Do you care to respond to that, Phil Scott?
Well, as you are well aware, we did raise the age to 21. So during that, during all of that, those changes in our gun laws, so we did take a proactive stance in that respect. So again, you know, being governor isn't about a knee-jerk reaction to every single issue. It's about tempering and a thoughtful approach.
Phil Scott, do you have a question for David Zuckerman?
I do. Lieutenant Governor, you've made it very clear your lack of support of the Vermont National Guard, especially the Air Guard, with a lot of the comments you've made over the years. As you know, the governor serves as their commander in chief. They look up to, respect, and watch what they're doing. And I'm wondering, how do you intend to mend that fence that was vastly destroyed, knocked down in some of the comments you made?
Well, my concerns were about basing the F-35s here and the noise and the impact on our neighborhoods and communities. And I'm hearing from people right now that is still a concern, but they are now here. And I have also many times visited the Guard base and spoken very positively about our citizen Guard folks who are here to protect us, who are here to rebuild us in cases of emergency, who are here to help us as they did in Hurricane or Tropical Storm Irene. We know that folks in Vermont take time away from their families to protect us here in Vermont, to go overseas and stand up for American values across the world. And we do have to respect, and I do fully respect, they're putting themselves and their lives on the line, and their families, and how their families are often very nervous when their loved ones are overseas. So I fully respect the work of our Guard. I support our National Guard's men and women in the role they do, and I will continue to do so as I have.
Do you have a follow-up, Governor Scott?
Senator Sanders, Senator Leahy, Congressman Welch all support the F-35. If you had the opportunity at this point, would you say, let's turn away the F-35 for Vermont if you had that opportunity as governor?
Well, that's a hypothetical that you know isn't actually true. But no, the planes are here. They are doing their work, and they will stay.
David Zuckerman, a second question for Phil Scott.
Well, this question is related to the climate. We talked about the Global Warming Solutions Act earlier. My plan is to invest in Vermont and Vermonters, get rid of many of the hurdles placed on a renewable energy and solar that have gone into place in the last 4 years, costing us over 500 jobs, build affordable housing in town centers, and weatherize low-income and fixed-income Vermonters' homes. You often refer to your investments in the EV programs as central to addressing the climate emergency. And I agree, electric vehicles are important. But to meet our climate goals, we must replace 50 to 80,000 vehicles, internal combustion engines, on our roads by 2025. At your rate of funding, we would take over 160 years to reach that goal. What other climate priorities are you advancing to dramatically change our carbon emissions?
Well, again, I'm very happy to hear that you agree with many of the initiatives, weatherization and so forth, that we've been putting forward and working on for a number of years. Our focus has been on accelerating the transition to electrification of the transportation sector, because I know that's where at least 50% of the emissions come from. Increase investments to help Vermonters purchase electric vehicles is going to be essential. We have to let technology catch up as well. I mean, we're seeing vast improvements over the last 3 years. It's been remarkable how many companies have now moved forward industrial with upping their inventory of electric vehicles and battery storage and so forth. We've expanded EVs in the state fleet. We've increased investments to expand EV charging stations. We've worked with our regional partners to update the Zero Emission Vehicle Action Plan. We joined other states to electrify trucks and buses. This is going to, we're going to have to work together again across state government to reach these emission goals, but it's going to take industry. It's going to take the technology to catch up as well. It's not going to be linear. It's not going to be point A to point B and think you're going to do it in a straight line. It's going to be a slope curve, and we're going to get there. I'm confident of that because I'm very excited about electric vehicles, because that's where we make the biggest gains: electric vehicles, large scale battery storage, and weatherization.
David Zuckerman, would you like to ask a question? Follow up.
Do I get to follow? Yeah. Well, with
but make sure it's a question.
Well, I thought I got to follow up on the answer.
Briefly. No, you get a follow up question for the governor.
Well, I guess with respect to weatherization, I'm curious because, of course, the legislature has moved to really expand weatherization. It's true money has been spent on weatherization. I'm not really sure that was your initiative. That's been going on for quite some time. I'm curious, though, there are many technologies, whether it's regenerative agriculture, installing broadband, doing a much more aggressive weatherization approach. Why have you not done more aggressive investments in those technologies that already exist when we know the climate crisis is as present and real and endangering our way of life in Vermont as it is? Why haven't you done more?
Well, again, as the leader of the Senate, overseeing the Senate in your role, you've seen the inaction in some respects on the legislature. They've turned down more of my proposals, or haven't adopted more of my proposals than I have of them. I don't remember turning down any proposals from the legislature in this regard. I don't remember any, zero. So, except for the Global Warming Solutions Act, which was unconstitutional from my perspective.
All right, so Phil Scott, another question for you, from you, for David Zuckerman.
Again, Lieutenant Governor, we're talking about some of the climate change and so forth. And you know that I've been long opposed to the destruction of our ridgelines for industrial wind projects. In fact, I've been successful in stopping them. So I'm wondering, what's your position at this point in time on littering our beautiful mountains with large scale wind? Is this a sacrifice that Vermonters need to make in order to accomplish your goals with climate change?
Well, I appreciate the question. And when we look back in history, at one time, adding round silos next to barns was considered an abomination of our landscape, a destruction of the beauty and the serenity of our state. And now we look to those as a part of our history and our past and the beauty that they represent. For me, when I think about our planet and I think about renewable energy, we need both distributed energy, where we support solar energy on folks' roofs, small scale wind, and we do need to look around the state to find those few places where we can place industrial wind with sensitivity to our environment, making sure we're not going into the most sensitive locations, but also to produce the energy that we need in Vermont. We know through this crisis that we have to become more locally sustainable, from food to energy. And so I do support a very practiced approach, a very delicate approach in those few locations to put them in.
Do you have a follow-up, Phil Scott?
So you're comparing silos to the wind towers on the Lowell ridgeline. They're comparable in your world.
Well, when I actually stand near a silo, it looks much bigger than a wind turbine. But frankly, when I drive by solar fields, solar panels on people's roofs, and wind turbines, and I think about my daughter and her future, and I think Vermonters and our future with maple industry, with the ski industry, with farming, where right now we're seeing drought in parts of our state, I think about how these are symbols of how we care about our future for our families, for our children, and for our grandchildren. If we only think about our moment in the need now, we will fail the future for our next generations.
David Zuckerman and Phil Scott speaking today in the VPR Vermont PBS gubernatorial debate held here on September 24th, as some Vermonters may already be getting ready to send their mail-in ballots back to their town clerks in an election season held under challenging circumstances and made very different for voters and candidates alike as we all grapple with the global pandemic. When we come back, we'll share questions from our listeners and offer the candidates a chance to make a final pitch for your vote. Stay with us. Welcome back. to the VPR Vermont PBS debate series. I'm Jane Lindholm. This is the first of three debates we'll be having in this general election season. Today, we're hearing from two candidates for governor hoping to win your vote, incumbent Phil Scott and Lieutenant Governor and challenger David Zuckerman. Scott is the Republican nominee, while Zuckerman won the nomination of both the Democratic and the Progressive parties. We've collected questions from listeners and viewers over the last several days and weeks. So in this section of the debate, we're going to be asking you questions from Vermonters. You'll have a minute to answer each question, and there may be a follow-up if warranted. The first couple of questions we're going to ask you actually come from Vermont students. Questions were solicited from local high school students through the Vermont PBS Distance Learning Partnership with the Agency of Education. But the questions we are using were chosen by our editorial team with no influence from the partnership. Padma M., an 11th grader at Brattleboro Union High School, writes, "While background checks are required when purchasing a firearm in the state of Vermont under legislation passed in 2018, this rule does not always apply when a firearm is switching ownership within direct family members. Should background checks be required for the buyer, no matter their relationship to the seller? Why or why not?" Phil Scott, you get to go first.
Well, again, we passed those changing gun laws over the last couple of years, and they were significant. A lot of controversy and a lot of respects. From our perspective, in working with the legislature, we felt that passing firearms from family member to family member was just fair. If your grandfather passed away, that they would want you to have that hunting rifle that they had used when they were kids and pass it on to a family member without a background check. It seemed reasonable to me, but we did close that loophole where you could pass firearms on privately. Now they have to go through a licensed firearm dealer and get the respective background check. So I think, again, it was a balance. I think it made all kinds of sense, and I think we should continue in this regard.
So is your position on this, Phil Scott, backed up by the science, or is it basically bowing to political pressure, which would have been too much to require background checks even for direct family members?
Yeah, I don't know if there's any science available that would lead us to the conclusion that family members passing a firearm on to a son or daughter or granddaughter or grandson would preclude any safety aspects. Again, I don't know if the science is available. I haven't seen any if it is. But again, I just thought this was reasonable, as did the legislature. And that's why we made this move.
David Zuckerman, Padma's question for you: should background checks be required for the buyer, no matter the relationship to the seller?
Well, first, I want to thank Padma and other youth for engaging in our democracy. We are seeing so many more youth engaging in democracy and their future and asking such thoughtful questions like this. And so I just want to say thank you to all of you, particularly Padma, for this question. I don't think that part of the law needs to be changed, because you do have that relationship. You know your own son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter as you are transferring those. However, as we stated earlier, I do support getting rid of I do support implementing a 24-hour waiting period for the purchasing of guns. I also support closing the Charleston loophole, which allows folks who are getting a background check, if that background check doesn't clear in 3 days, to then be able to purchase a gun without having cleared a background check. To me, those two policies, which both would make it safer for Vermonters and for Vermont children. And so there are changes we need to make.
We have another question from a student, from Sylvie N., who's an 11th grader at Brattleboro Union High School as well, and asks, "Upon election, what do you plan to do to combat the highly disproportionate incarceration rate of Black and Brown people in comparison to others?" David Zuckerman, you get to go first.
Well, there's a number of things that need to be done here. It includes looking at our education system, where we already disproportionately also suspend and detain communities of color at rates of 4 to 1 relative to their population in our schools. We need to look towards our law enforcement training and bias in how they approach situations as to why we pull over and check more brown and black individuals in our state as they're driving down the highway, suspicious for simply driving while being black. We need to look at policies like Sarah Fair George is doing here in Chittenden County, where they are getting rid of cash bail, where people are incarcerated, particularly those who don't have the money. And again, we've had a systemic economic policy in this country that has made it so our black and brown brothers and sisters don't have as much resources to pay those sorts of bail. We have to look at our cannabis laws, which thankfully, and I hope the governor will sign it, will expunge 10,000 criminal records disproportionately affecting black and brown Vermonters because of our drug laws of the past. We need to look and review at all of our laws in our criminal justice system to make sure they are not disproportionately affecting our BIPOC communities.
Phil Scott, Sylvie's question goes to you as well. How would you combat the high incarceration rate of black and brown people in comparison with other people?
Well, overall, we've significantly decreased the population in prisons over the last year. We've reduced that to about 350 at this point. We've implemented fair and impartial policing. I think that's important as well to make sure that we have a better training for our law enforcement community. And the executive order that I produce, which has with a racial equity council, has been forwarding initiatives to combat this as well. So we've taken a lot of steps. We have a long ways to go. We need to continue to work to reform our criminal justice system, and that's taking place in the legislature as we speak. But I think we all agree spending money on diversion, justice reinvestment, and prevention is more efficient and better use of money than staffing and maintaining our correctional facilities. So we have a long ways to go, but we're working on that path, and I believe that we'll get there. Bringing the offenders back into Vermont is important as well, and I believe building a new facility is going to be key to doing that.
This question comes from Nancy in Essex Junction. Nancy writes, I would like to know how each candidate feels about Prop 5, guaranteeing reproductive rights in the Vermont Constitution. And I'm going to read the text of this ballot proposition just to make sure that everybody who's watching and listening is on the same page. It reads in full, that an individual's right to personal reproductive autonomy is central to the liberty and dignity to determine one's own life course and shall not be denied or infringed unless justified by a compelling state interest achieved by the least restrictive means. And a reminder that this ballot measure has to be approved by two consecutive legislatures, so it wouldn't be on the ballot for voters until November of 2022. So what is your position on this possible amendment to the Vermont Constitution? Phil Scott.
Well, again, the governor is not involved in constitutional amendments. I think that Lieutenant Governor Zuckerman would agree with that. I signed, I think it was H 57, one of the most expansive pro-choice laws in the country, and very proud to have done so. So again, we'll see how this works. Very difficult to amend the Constitution as it should be. But again, we'll see how this works through the system that we have in place.
Broadly speaking, though, you support the idea.
I support, I've supported pro-choice laws in the past. I'll continue to do so in the future.
David Zuckerman, what's your position on this possible amendment to the Constitution?
Well, I think this constitutional amendment is critical, particularly at this moment in time with the recent passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You know, we are watching the threat of women's reproductive freedom bear down on us in Washington. As governor, I would be outspoken every single day right now while the discussion is going on in Washington with this president, Republican President Trump, Republican leader Mitch McConnell. I would be speaking out every day for the process and the democracy that Vermonters stand for. I appreciate the governor's statement the other day, and he was right on with that. However, this is an imperative that should be being addressed every single day by decent Republicans all across the country. In fact, many are. Colin Powell, Mrs. McCain, former Governor Kasich. We need Republican leaders to to stand up every single day to the destruction of our democracy that's going on in Washington, not passive single statements that are going to allow women's reproductive freedoms to go by the wayside for the next 30 or 40 years. I am terribly frightened for my daughter and all the young women across this state for their future. And as governor, I would be daily speaking out to make sure voices are heard by governors and leaders across the country to protect that right.
This is a question from Joanne in Johnson. Joanne sent us a lot of information about the state college system, which she says is significantly underfunded, and she asserts that the state is not living up to its statutory obligation to support the state college system in whole or in substantial part with state funds. Joanne asks, what is your plan to help the Vermont state college system survive now and in the future? David Zuckerman.
Well, I think there's a number of things we need to do. We clearly needed to put forward the bridge funding that the governor did not put in either of his budgets. It was a contingency line if we somehow had a windfall, which is very unexpected for this next year. But we needed to make sure it was foundationally in the budget to make sure our students and our employees and the businesses around those institutions knew they had the backing of our state government, that those institutions are going to survive long into the future. We then need to look at creative repurposing. We need to look at what the academic focus are, and there are groups all over the state looking at that, including the panel created by government. But we also need to look at how we could attract out-of-state students in this moment, in this COVID crisis, to say our state campuses are safer than major institutions in major cities. We could attract students with focused curricula around elder care, nursing, teaching, and social workers that we know we need more of for good jobs for Vermonters in the future. And we need to do that collaboratively, both raising resources for that focus and drawing in students and helping Vermonters have that opportunity.
Phil Scott, how would you help the state college system survive now and in the future?
Well, it's interesting to hear the Lieutenant Governor suddenly become such an ally in the state college system. Welcome to the club. Under my administration, we significantly increased base funding to the state colleges over the last 3 or 4 years. In fact, in my very first budget, I talked about how much we needed to do more. Unfortunately, the legislature cut my funding proposals, and I don't remember the Lieutenant Governor calling on his party to follow my lead back then. I will also take exception to the $30 million that I put into the budget of CARES money, federal money, that with more flexibility, we'd be able to utilize for the bridge funding for the state colleges. We actually used that. I give great credit to the legislature for becoming creative, but they took CARES money, federal money, found another way around, and funded one-time money for the public safety to free up general fund dollars to utilize for that. So they did use the $30 million, actually it was less, $23 million, for bridge funding. So they took my lead, but they made it better. They found a creative path forward to utilize that money, and I give them great credit for doing so.
We're running short on time, so I am going to move on to a lightning round, and we will make sure that you have chance for final statements as well. Should the loophole in Act 46 that allows merged educational districts to unmerge and break apart if they can't agree on things be closed? You have 20 seconds, up to 20 seconds to answer these. Phil Scott, you go first.
No, I mean, I think it's working at this point in time. I think we are going to see more communities want to get out of Act 46. But again, that was the law of the land. It wasn't something that I created. Not perfect. But we have some challenges in education, and they sought to address them.
David Zuckerman, should that loophole be closed?
No, I don't think that loophole should be closed, but we do need to look at those situations where some of the small schools are getting railroaded to be closed by boards that are made up where they really have no voice to protect their small schools. So I think we do need to look at that. And while the governor didn't introduce or pass the law, he is in charge of administering the law. And the way we wrote the law was not going to create as many forced mergers as his administration proposed and implemented.
How has the global pandemic affected your beliefs or your values in a way that might change how you govern from here on out? David Zuckerman, 20 seconds.
Well, it hasn't changed a lot of my beliefs or values, but what I've been impressed with is the incredible sense of community that came out across the state, the mutual aid groups that looked to make sure their hungry neighbors were fed, the collaborative ideas that I helped instigate with Representative Matt Byrong and Representative Gene O'Sullivan to create the Everyone Eats program, where we could use COVID money to support our restaurants, to employ their people and pay, and make meals for Vermonters. That is that collaborative approach that I think we need to use moving forward.
Phil Scott.
Well, through every crisis, whether it was Irene or this pandemic, I think that it's reflective on Vermonters and their ability to come together, neighbors helping neighbors. And we've done that with the pandemic. We did it with Irene. And again, I'm very proud of what we've accomplished together, working together, as opposed to what we've seen in other states and in all different types of ways. So I'll continue to govern, to work together during a crisis to build coalitions in order to help Vermonters. And I think that everyone banded together to do just that.
All right, just a yes or no on this one. Ida, an eighth grader at Twinfield Middle School, wants to know, do you support banning TikTok? Phil Scott.
No.
David Zuckerman.
No, my daughter loves it.
All right, so we have time now for a final question that gives you a chance to talk directly to voters about why they should choose you. You're going to have a minute to answer this final question. Please keep it to a minute. Phil Scott, why should voters vote for consistency, especially in a state with an overwhelming liberal majority in the legislature, when we're approaching a new fiscal year that will see massive budget pressures and a priority to focus on vulnerable Vermonters, those who are out of work, those who are vulnerable to illness, and in an unstable national environment? Why should Vermonters stay with you?
Well, thank you, Jane, and VPR and PBS for hosting this event. You know, when I became governor, my hope was that when I left office, I would leave Vermont in better shape than when I found it. Then along came COVID-19 and a once-in-a-century health and economic crisis with it, which eroded many of the gains we've made over the last 3 years. As we've faced these many challenges, over these past 7 months or so, I'm really proud of how Vermont has led the nation. I'm confident we're going to win this war. But to do so, we'll need pragmatic and bold leadership as we work to recover from the fallout of this pandemic and rebuild stronger than before. And I think my team is the key here, has proven itself with me at the wheel. As we move forward, I'll continue to focus on the three priorities that have guided my administration since the very beginning: growing the economy, making Vermont more affordable, and protecting the most vulnerable.
David Zuckerman. Why should Vermonters vote for change when we're in the midst of a global pandemic and we have so far had some of the best outcomes in the nation for how our state has dealt with this virus and its health outcomes? Why should Vermonters choose you?
Well, thank you everyone for tuning in. I'm David Zuckerman. I'm a farmer, small business owner, and your lieutenant governor. You have a clear choice before you: two stable, capable hands to help us through this COVID crisis. And I would keep Dr. Levine as part of that team. But only one has a track record of building for the future. It is imperative that we have leadership that can do both: take care in the moment, manage efficiently and effectively, as well as look toward building for a better future. As a farmer and public servant, I've done that for over 20 years. Whether it's growing food or building opportunities for Vermonters, we need to use the resources we have to both address today's concerns and tomorrow's needs. As governor, I will ensure Vermonters are taking home more pay and have affordable housing. I will support renewable energy and weatherization to both create jobs and lower your bills. And I will fight for every Vermonter to have access to the education and training they need. This is the most important election of our lifetime. We must elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris this November. We are all grateful for the leadership that has guided us through this pandemic, but now is our chance to elect a leader who will bring us hope and build us forward. I'm asking for your vote for a better future and a stronger Vermont.
Well, that concludes today's VPR Vermont PBS debate between candidates for Governor David Zuckerman and Phil Scott. Thank you for participating and good luck to you both. We had production and promotional support today from Lydia Brown, Matthew Smith, Emily Aiken, Abigail Giles, Michelle Owens, Anna St. Marie, Chris Albertine, Holt Albee, Brian Stevenson, Kyle Blair, Dave Rice, Emily Taylor, and Anna Post. We're back next week with debates for Lieutenant Governor and U.S. House. You can find the full schedule at vpr.org and to send your questions for the candidates to comments@vpr.org. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thank you very much for joining us today.